Yeah, thanks very much, and glad to be back up here. It's a fun crew. I hope we get some good questions. If not, at least we'll have some fun. I'm not wearing a tie today, so I can be a little bit looser. So it was probably close to 10 years ago when I was down at a conference in Georgia Tech, and I was on a panel with a bunch of CTOs from companies, and the topic of the conference was emerging threats in cyberspace. Now, if you think back 10 years, those were the early days of computer security in some sense. So I got up there, I said, you know, I was, of course, I'm the last guy to speak because I'm the govy guy up there. And I said, you know, it's not so much that there are emerging threats, is that there are emerging targets. Because what I'm seeing hitting us here, companies, whatever, I've been facing from foreign governments for 10 years. So welcome to the club, guys. Now, when you think about that and what that means, go back a few years ago, and it was a Cold War back in the 50s when I was in elementary school. It was Russia. Remember, we talked about the threat adversary model, capabilities, resources, intent, motivation, risk aversion, access. So the Cold War was two pieces, espionage and that atom bomb. Back in the 50s, when I was in elementary school, about once a month an alarm would go off, and we'd all dive under our desks because this was how we would react if the Russians were dropping an atom bomb on our school. Now, that's probably not a really adequate reaction to protect you, but it does mean that everybody did it. It's not like we have fire alarms today. A lot of people close their doors and pretend they've walked out of the building because you've got work to do. But we all dove under the desk because we knew that there was a chance that those guys really were going to drop an atom bomb on our school. Now, I'm thinking that they probably weren't going to be aiming at my little school in Connecticut. That probably wasn't really a good target for them. But you did understand it. And for a lot of us, our parents had been through the war. They knew what bombs were like. Half the kids in my class had bomb shelters in their basements. So we understood the threat. Somehow, the threat at that point in time of somebody dropping a bomb on your head, that was very real. And that was very easy to understand, so it was easy to react to. Things changed for me when I walked into the door at NSA. I walked in, I was a kid, and first day at NSA, there were 30 other kids in a room. We were all mathematicians, and we were brought in to break codes. So at the end of the second day, there was an old guy in the back of the room. That probably means he was about 30. So he stood up, and he said, okay, now I want to tell you guys something. He said, when you walked in the door and put on that badge that you wear, you became targets. The Russians have a file on you. They're going to be looking for to take advantage of any weakness at all, any risk you take, any mistake you make, they're going to be there. You know, if you have money problems, you have a drinking problem, anything you need help with, they'll be there to help you. He said, you know, if you're in a bar having a beer and a real good-looking girl or a real good-looking boy comes up and they're just fascinated with you, be careful, because it's not that you're interesting. You know, he said, I've been with you for 2 days. You're not. He's probably right. We're a bunch of math geeks. It's like the, you know, the joke about the mathematician. Mathematician gets invited to a party. That was a joke. Okay. So that's where we were. And it's true. If you look back at those times, every once in a while, we do a fun thing where they'd come and they'd show us some pictures. Watch out if you see this guy. Watch out if you see this guy, because those are the guys. So it was an interesting world back then. It was us and the Russians. And we knew the game we were playing. And it changed for me from being, you know, are they going to drop an atom bomb on my school? Probably not, too. Are they going to take advantage of me if they can? Yeah, they probably will. And they will be looking out. And you just live your life differently. Every time somebody asks you a question, you just think. And you automatically do that. you know, people used to try to talk to me on airplanes, and they say, "So what do you do?" And I say, "I'm a spy." You know what? They turn around right away. So you never have to worry about that, but at least it was honest. So now the good news is there was honor among spies, and we knew that there were rules in the game, that the Russians would follow and we would follow. They were going to look for any weakness. They were going to take advantage of me in any way they could. But they weren't going to kidnap me. They weren't going to shoot me. They weren't going to do anything like that. If they could blackmail me because I did something stupid, yep, I was in trouble. And so you live your life differently. When I was on that panel, they asked people on the panel, how many of you do online banking? I wouldn't do it. I was the only one who didn't do it. Just too risky, because I knew I was a target. Yeah, I knew they were on my phone lines. I knew they were monitoring my internet. And when I say I knew it, I mean I wasn't worried about it. I knew that they were. So that's the situation. By the way, since I retired, I tried that online banking stuff. It is really convenient. If any of you aren't doing it, you ought to try it. It's good stuff. So along about 1980, I met a guy named Viktor Shamov. I think I mentioned him yesterday. He was the director of information assurance for the KGB back in the 70s, and he came over to our side. We had guys that had gone over to their side too. It's equal opportunity switching. They're looking for a reason. I think he came over here for a better way of life. I think the guys who went over from NSA were looking for ideology. There are different reasons, but Victor's a fun guy. Everyone, you know, we get together every once in a while. We have lunch together. He loves crab cakes. That's why he's near the CIA. That we have good crab cakes down in Maryland. It's okay. That's true. But we're talking every once in a while, and you can still tell there's a little bit of Russia in Viktor. Every once in a while, we'll be joking about things, and I'll say, "Yeah, that's a hard problem." And you get it from me, "Not for us. It was easy." Okay. Every once in a while, he just can't help but do that. Fun guy. I can always remember I'm a target. There are different levels of targets. Yeah, you all are targets, and you're probably like, you're not the base level of target, because you've got some stuff that people might want. But you're not the my level of target, because you didn't have that crypto. And that's what the Russians wanted. They wanted our secrets. They wanted our crypto. Viktor's a different level of target, because he's gone over to the other side. And that makes him a real target. So, you know, I can tell how nervous he is based on where he wants to sit in the restaurant. If he's not feeling nervous, he wants to sit in the corner, because that way he can see everything that's going on at all times. If he is feeling nervous, he wants me to sit in the corner, and he's going to shrink down opposite me, because he's going to be watching my glasses, and he can see everything that goes on in the restaurant in my glasses, and he'll recognize them before they recognize him. And, you know, that's actually not a joke. That's his life. That's tough. So when you're playing this game, for a guy like Viktor, and not me so much, because I'm not quite that in the game that much, but it is different. I remember we were talking one day, and he said, "You know, interesting. I was over here for 2 years before they knew I defected." And I'm thinking, crap. You know, when I'm sitting in that job, I go on TDY and there'll be faxes waiting for me when I check into a hotel. I got to call the office every hour to see what's going on. How on earth do you get away for 2 years and they don't know you're gone? Which is what I said. "Viktor, how'd you get away for 2 years before they knew you were gone?" He said, "Well, the day I left," said that there was a traffic accident in Moscow. My car was involved. It caught fire, and it burned. It was really bad. There were four bodies in it, burned beyond recognition, a man, a woman, two children. So they figured, you know. And I said, "How the hell did you do that?" He said, "When you're KGB, it's easy. You just requisition bodies. They show up." So I'm thinking, do you think they have a stockpile of bodies? Or they say, 42 long. There's one over there. It's a different life. If he's a fun guy, very much into the American way of life, but still a target. We talk about the good old days when it was just them and us. One day I was sitting there. It was interesting. So I'm sitting there with the KGB guy, and he says, I want to talk to you seriously for a minute. Now, Victor almost never talks anything but serious, so this I had figured this must be really serious if he wanted to talk serious. So he grabbed my arm, and he's holding it tight. He says, I want you to know you can't trust the Chinese. And I'm thinking, yeah, there's got to be a little more to it than this. But here's what he meant. There was honor among spies. Victor and I knew where the lines in the sand were. We knew the rules we played by, and we knew that there were things we would do. What he was telling me was there was no line in the sand for them. Remember that threat adversary model. This is an interesting model. Capabilities, resources, intent, motivation, risk aversion, and access. If you think of that intent and motivation, when it was us and the Russians, I knew what their intent was, and I knew what their motivation was, and I was very comfortable with that because their intent and motivation was exactly what mine was. It was to protect my country, make sure that no one surprised me, and that's what he was doing at the same time. And what he was telling me was he had the same threat adversary model, and he didn't understand the intent and motivation of the Chinese. And that's scary. So when I looked at that model, capabilities and resources, we modeled ourselves after the Russians. Right? Our threat adversary model, same as theirs, theirs same as ours. Same amount of capabilities, same amount of resources, same intent, same motivation, similar risk aversion, similar access. That was it. It's a good model. Other countries don't fit that model. Victor said, interestingly, he said, when he was over there in the KGB, he had a lot of allies, just like we have a lot of allies. He said he didn't trust any one of them as much as he trusted us. And that didn't mean that we were best friends. It means he understood us, and he trusted what we were going to do, and he knew we weren't going to break that trust. Kind of an interesting thing. I did not tell him I trusted him more than any of my allies, because I really didn't, and I always tell the truth. But I did trust him more than any of my other adversaries. So that you know, that's halfway there. That makes him feel a little bit good. Now, the nice thing about this threat adversary model and this being a target where I was a target, it was a very fair game because I signed up to be a target. I said, yep, I'll be a target. That's good. I can live with that, and I know the rules, and that's a fair game. Today's world is very different because a lot of people are targets who didn't sign up to be targets. And I don't like that kind of game. Yeah, if you're going to play a game, you ought to agree to play it. You shouldn't be a target if you're not agreeing to play it. So that's something that we've really got to take care of. If you think about that old war with your adversary, anything they were going to do, attribution was easy, and that's kind of nice. You know, let's look at some of the people that got nailed. When we caught Walker, you're familiar with Walker. Walker was a case where the guy invested in he needed money. He invested in a bar. The bar was losing money, so he figured, what could he sell? He's got these little strips of paper. He can sell those. They had holes in them. They weren't worth much anyway. So he sold those, and that was a good deal because we figured that our crypto was pretty good, and it was, but not if you've got the crypto variables, not that secure. So that's the game with Walker. He needed money. Ames, what happened with Ames? Ames felt like he wasn't getting the respect he deserved. He was the smartest guy in that whole organization, and yet nobody was looking to him to run it. So doggone it, if they didn't appreciate him, he would find someone who did. And the Russians did. That's the kind of game. Martin and Mitchell, ideology. What are some of the other things? The Great Seal. Remember when they gave this Great Seal, and they told him that they're like a a class of third graders had carved it for the president. Did you guys ever see that seal? Boy, that is beautifully carved. I don't think third graders did that. I know they didn't build the recorder and transmitter that was in the back. So that was neat. You can see the one that we have in the museum is just a replica of that one. I don't know where the real one is, but it is really nicely done. The chair rail, it's pretty cool. The interesting thing about all these cases, if you think about that threat adversary model, it didn't cost a whole lot to make that seal. Capability's not really hard. Intent and motivation, forget. Risk. They put a lot into that great seal, and they tried it. Didn't work. But you know what? That was the one bullet that'll never work again. They can never try to give us a great seal again and figure we're going to hang it on a wall and they get to listen to things. And chair rail, that chair rail, that's probably never going to work again because we're going to be looking for that. And that's the risk of so many of these things, which are one-to-one, person-to-person, where you've got to get in and do something. It takes a lot of time. It takes timing. I know the guys in our government who do this stuff, and they plan this stuff out for a long, long time when they're going to be doing something. And they practice, and everything's got to work right. And if it fails, then they've lost that opportunity, and it hurts. It's a different world today. It's not the same. If, the whole world is changing. One of the interesting things about that world back then was crypto was so simple. If you look at Vincent, it had good cryptography in it. It had an on-off switch. It had plain cipher. You know, you could talk in cipher on. It's secure. Hasn't changed in 35 years. That's kind of neat. And that crypto that was protecting people didn't know it was there. It was invisible. Because you were talking into a radio, the guy was listening at the other end. The crypto, it was just there as a tool to help. Systems are so much more complicated today. We've still got crypto. Can crypto work? Can crypto really protect us? Are we just not smart enough to understand how crypto can protect us? Now, I don't see much beyond crypto that's going to really do it, because if you don't have crypto there, you know you're not protected. You're transmitting and it's gone. We've got to be smart enough to figure out how to use it to protect us. People all use crypto every day. You know, my kids use crypto. They don't know they're using crypto, but when they communicate over the internet, they're using it. Is it secure? Yeah, every time I go to one of these conferences, I find out it's less secure than I thought it was. I'm pretty low now, so I don't think it's not going to get much lower in my estimation, but it's depressing. Got to get there. Now, the world has really changed. What are some of the changes? When I think back to when I was young and looked at a big company was, say, General Motors. So what was the value of General Motors back then? I don't mean how many dollars. I mean, where was their value? Their value was in the plants that they had, the steel that they had, the inventory that they had, the cars. So millions of dollars worth of that stuff, very hard to steal. How are you going to get it? You're going to go over and I'm going to take those million cars right there. Yeah, good luck. I hope you got a big pocket. But in today's world, look at a big company. Look at Google. Where's their value? It's intellectual property. It's zeros and ones. Very easy to steal, and you don't have to be sitting in this country to steal it. That access is killer. Look at another thing. Look at money. You know, when I was young, we just used money when we bought things. It's weird. We had this paper money stuff. Yeah, I try to use paper money now, and then the people look at me like, what am I going to do with that? You got a drawer. You're going to put it in the drawer. It's got little slots in it. They're not used to that. But what a change, because if people, you know, if I handed a clerk $10, it's not like they were going to record that serial number and get a lot of $10 bills. They were going to get $10. Today you hand people a piece of plastic, and you're taking a risk, because that could be used for other purposes. Electronic banking, you can lose a lot of money. It's not like the old days where if you lost two checks, you know, they aren't going to write huge checks on those things because they aren't going to get cashed. So there were limited losses. Life has gotten a lot easier, a lot simpler, tremendous functionality. And it's functionality for us, and it's easier for the adversary. Everybody goes after us. So what's happened? Well, remember when the Russians were going after us, it was about one attack a decade. And an attack might be a walker, or it might be an Ames, or it might be a gunman. Remember, gunman's the place where they replaced the stability bars with that nice little bar that had the recording device in it so that they were getting our typed papers. You get those things. Buckshot Yankee. You know, who would have thought that when you capture a guy you capture a terrorist with a thumb drive, it's going to have a present from Russia in it. You know, it's just something you didn't expect. So you take the risk and you put it in the system and you pay for that risk. The world is a completely different place. Back in the 60s and 70s, the target was the U.S. government. So I was a target because I was a crippy. In fact, one of the things I used to do, not the current director of information assurance or the previous one, but the one before that, when I was his TD, we used to argue all the time about who was the better target for the Russians, whether it was him or me. And I would always win because he knew where he knew what the budget was, and he knew what the personnel numbers were, and he knew what the strategy was downtown. But you know, the Russians already knew all that stuff. I could draw all the diagrams of all the crypto, and he couldn't do any of that stuff. Now I'm hoping that they thought he was the target. So, but in reality, they probably were after it. Everybody in the building. But the good news is that nobody ever walked up to me in a bar, because I really didn't go to bars. You know, I'm that mathematician guy who went home and watched the news. Partly because I knew that there was a risk. And yeah, I was down at an FBI conference about 2 years ago, and there was one of the FBI agents was giving a talk, and she was telling the people in the audience to watch out because she could guarantee that they were going to be approached by a Russian spy in a bar someday. And I raised my hand. I said, 40 years. I've been waiting 40 years. And I don't think my chances are improving. You know, I just like to see if I could recognize it. But yeah, pretty clearly, if anybody came up and talked to me, I'd recognize it. I wasn't going to be picky about it. So, from the Russians, about one attack a decade. What's been going on lately? Is it one a decade? No, it's really not. It's been more than that. You know, the government last year, 41,000 cyber attacks. 41,000. Talked to McAfee the other day. They said that they're up to 60,000 unique pieces of malware a day. Can you imagine if we were trying to write signatures for 60,000 unique pieces of malware a day? What would you do? You'd turn your laptop on and it would spin. It's a mess. That's a lot. Now it's not just government either. There are other people that have been hit. RSA got hit. Lockheed Martin got hit. A lot of other companies got hit. By the way, those are just some big ones. Not just this country. Mitsubishi. Did you follow the Mitsubishi when they were hit? You know, they make submarines and things like that. They're of interest. So it came out and they said, we didn't lose anything. A week later they said, well, it's possible we lost something. And then 2 weeks later it was, we think we lost something. 3 weeks later, we might have lost some submarine stuff. And then I stopped reading because it was getting depressing. The problem is I don't think people know what they lose. I remember one time, it was cool. I was we were noticing at the end of a day that there was a lot of stuff. It was a Friday. Everything happens on Friday afternoon, by the way. I used to hate Friday afternoons. But Friday afternoon, it always happens because they've got the whole weekend to play. We noticed that an agency was losing a lot of information, a lot of information on a Friday afternoon. It was late. It was about 5:30. So we called them. We said, "Oh, you got a problem. You're hemorrhaging really bad." And they said, "We'll tell our system admins when they come back in on Monday." And we said, "You got to be kidding! You can't call them in for this." No, they weren't going to call them in, but they did tell them Monday. And the system admin said, "Good news, it stopped." All right. Big win for them. That's what happens. Digi Notar, that's one of my favorites. You're familiar with that one where they lost the signing certificates? Put them out of business. But the mess you can make with that, it's a sorry situation. So the adversary, interestingly, the adversary wants something. It's typically information. In this world, the adversary has split up into different pieces, and different adversaries are going after different pieces. So there's personal information where you can get individuals' money, like the stock scheme we talked about. There's intellectual property from companies. There's intellectual property from government, like NASA, Department of Energy, that kind of stuff. Agriculture. Agriculture Department is a big target. Everybody wants to, for two reasons. Everybody wants to know what's going on with food, and everybody wants to know how to make money on futures. So a lot of money there in the Agriculture Department. Who would guess they'd be a big target? Only the adversaries. NASDAQ, if you can get a second lead on information, make a ton of money. It's scary. I told you about the bank that was using DES. That's the level of security. We were talking at lunch about where do we need people that understand the problem, understand the threat, can solve these problems. We need them everywhere. It's not just government that needs it. Big companies need it. We need them in software development. We need them in the financials. We need it in the critical infrastructure, because that's where we're going to get hurt. That's where we're really vulnerable. We need these people. And we're all targets. The difference is that we're not all the same kind of target. We're a target of convenience in a lot of cases. Now, it's one of the neat things. If the Russian was going to approach someone in a bar, they'd be looking, they'd spend their evening trying to get that person. And today, you can send an email to 10 million people telling them that they won a lottery, and if they send you $500, you'll deposit the money in the, or even just send them your information about your bank account, and they'll deposit the money for you. They don't need all 10 million to hit. They just need one or two or 10. That's pretty good. I was talking to a general one time, and this is scary. We used to base our methods on what the Signals Intelligence Directorate did. And so you're talking about expected costs of things. And so I was talking to a general one time. He said, Just give me the 80% solution, because I know a 20% event will never happen. I'm thinking, he's never gone out on a sunny day and gotten rained upon, has he? Because 20% solutions do happen every week. It's one of those things. But that's the mentality. That's the mentality where the guy was saying, "Hey, I got a nuclear weapon. When I see that cyber attack coming, I'm going to know what to do." It's scary, but that is the reaction of people. I want to know who the adversary is so I can nail him. And that's because you're not going to be able to defend against it. Right? As a target, you've got to be really careful. And you still can't guarantee you're not going to be hit. You try to do everything right. You try to do everything smart. That doesn't mean you're going to be successful. I know a lot of really good people, who've been hit with viruses, and sometimes it's because they had help. So, you know, they have kids. The kids will do things. It's the old game. Push that okay, because I've got stuff to do. I can't be fooling around with this. And that's life. In the 0 days, they'll kill you. Attribution is so much harder than it used to be. And even with a country like Russia, where we think we know what they're doing, it's not like the missile. Attribution is really tough. You know, when a country says, might have come from here, might not have come from here, it certainly wasn't the government. It's not like the old days where, you know, how many high schools are building missiles over in your country? And then you think it was a high school? No, probably not. It was probably the country. And it's not like some friendly country is going to move a missile into your country to fire it so it looks like it's coming from you. That just doesn't happen. If the missile came from you, it was your government. Different world. The things that haven't changed are the basic tenets of security. Build it right, be careful, watch for the adversary. Know that the adversary is looking for you to make a mistake. Take a risk. When we talked about crypto, you can evaluate the heck out of a crypto logic so that you know that design is really good. And then somebody's going to implement it. And they may not implement it exactly the way you think they were going to. And they could introduce a problem. And then you got other things. You've got a crypto period. You're counting on these people to use that crypto variable for some length of time. Could be a message, could be a week, could be a month, could be 20 years. But you've got a policy that, and the 20 years is like in a satellite, because it's hard to go up and change that crypto up there. It just doesn't happen. So it's hardwired in. That's okay. But you're counting on people, whatever you tell them is the period, they've got to do it. If they don't do it, then they're taking a risk. You look at the kinds of risks we face today, the key loggers. That's nasty. It's nasty. I know some people that will put key loggers on their own machine just so they know what everybody else in the family's doing. Great to know what your kids are typing. And it's just a little bump in the cord. And sometimes they're doing it just so they can see if anybody else is doing anything on their machine, not in their family, just any friends coming in, or not friends even. The other problem we have is connectedness. That forward observer that used to have a radio and could talk to six people, now he's got a laptop. And he's got a laptop that's going to be able to talk to the Pentagon. That's what happened with Buckshot Yankee. You know, you're over there. The defense is set up in counter-terrorist mode, because that's who you're worried about. That's who's out there in front of you. And that's who you see as the adversary. But it's a great opportunity for the Russians to come in. And that's one of the things I kept telling the guys when they were going to the COD strategy. You know, I'd push real hard. We've got to get there. We've got to get this functionality out. We've got to do it. But then I get to play the other card. Don't forget that when you go out there with this COT stuff, it's a great answer if you're worried about the terrorist. But it's not a great answer if you're worried about Russia and China, because it's not going to stop those guys. It's just not that good. And that is the long-term threat. And we got to live with that. Like Victor said, the Chinese don't have a line in the sand. We don't know what they're up to. We don't know what they want to do. We do know that they are, like Shamov said, they're incredibly patient. And Shamov's a guy who would have worked me for 20 years to try to get something. It may be, for all I know. I don't know. You just never know. But if a guy who's willing to wait 20 or 30 years is telling you that this other guy over here is really patient, you got to wonder what's going to happen. What's the 100-year plan? I don't know. Now, the good news is that everybody's connected today, in every sense. Our forward observers are connected to the Pentagon. But our financial system is connected to all the other countries, too. So that's, in some sense, a level of protection that we have now that we didn't have before. And that's a good thing. this connectedness is something that it means that there's a risk out there, and people assume risks. And when you assume a risk, you've got to be ready. You've got to understand that you're likely going to pay for it in the long run. It's a scary situation. Like Cynthia doesn't get to use her thumb drive now because somebody assumed a risk. And hey, it wasn't her, but she's paying for it. And everybody else is paying the same way. We're all gonna suffer for that. We all suffer for other people's problems. If you look at RSA, you know, that's like a 1,000-person company, but it wasn't 1,000 people that made a mistake. It was one person, and yet they all paid for it. That's where we are today. The shared risk. Now, let me tell you a little story about shared risk. I want you to remember that when you guys are on that computer, you guys are targets, and you've opened up access to other countries, to people that are sitting over there, not paying attention to our laws, but they'll come after you. And just be aware that you are targets, and it's not fun. So let me tell you about a time when with a shared risk. So in 2002, the director of NSA was invited to give the lunchtime keynote at Black Hat. And so he called me and said, I want to give a talk that's really going to resonate with the kids out there. Can you write me bullets? I wasn't allowed to write the speech because he actually had speechwriters, but the speechwriters didn't know what to write about. So all I can do is take subject and turn it into nice prose. So I wrote up a nice set of bullets. I thought this was going to be a very good talk that he was going to do a great job on. And a week before the conference, I got a call, and it was from his exec, and he said, the director would like you to go out to Black Hat and give that speech for him. Now, I'm okay doing that because it's my speech, so I'm okay. And I said, sure, I could do that, but don't you think they're going to be a little disappointed when they expect a guy with a bunch of stars to appear on stage and it's me? And she said, no, we've actually talked to them, and they're okay with this. They're expecting you. So now, they were expecting me, and she was just asking me that day. This is interesting. So I said, so how come? Because I thought he was excited about doing this. And she said, well, you'll have to call Kemp and find out. Now, the good news is Kemp's a buddy of mine, a good friend of mine. So this is an easy phone call. The bad news is that Kemp is the head of security. So I called Kemp and I said, so Kemp, what's up? I'm heading out to Black Hat to give this talk for the director. And I know he wanted to do this. What's going on? And they said, I'm supposed to call you. And he said, well, you know, we have some very credible information that if the director shows up, there's going to be an assassination attempt. But we were talking it over, and we decided that you're not that good a target. So my first question to him is, don't you think I would have liked to have been in on that discussion? And what exactly does not that good a target mean? I'm not interpreting that as a compliment. So I went out, and I tell you, there were about 3,500 people there at lunch, and it was spread. And I've never scanned an audience like I scanned in that thing. I tell you, if a guy reached down to get his napkin, I was going to be on the floor. But needless to say, they did not attempt anything. So I guess that risk discussion and risk management decision was okay. I think that since then I've given talks to a lot of things. I've never really worried about being a target or anybody shooting at me. But every time I turn on my computer at night, I know that there are probably 1,000 people seeing if they can get in. And I know who some of them are. I don't know who most of them are. Keep that in mind, that It's risky. I characterize it as like crossing the street. I cross the street all the time. I mean, I look and I see there's nothing coming. But when you're a target, you have to worry about somebody parked over there pulling out and trying to hit you. It's a different world. We got to be careful. And the big thing is that we, the security professionals, we've got to find a way to protect the country. You know, why aren't we doing things smarter? Well, it seems to me, and by the way, I'm a mathematician, so you guys are the smart guys. You can fix this stuff. I hear a big attack is if you go to a camera and if you miss the M in .com and go to .co, and you go to LL Bean, there's a nice site there that has excellent sales on everything, and they will accept your credit card. You will not get delivery on any merchandise, but they will accept your credit card. Why do we let people do that? When you sign onto your computer the first time, why don't you ask people to whitelist domains they'd like to go to? They'll go to .com, they'll go to .gov maybe. Don't let them go anywhere else. They say to check email that's coming in. You can see that it looks like it comes from inside the enterprise, but it's coming from outside. Why doesn't the computer just tell me that? Instead of asking me to check. They tell me, don't open emails you don't trust. Yeah. Who does that? Who goes around saying, oh, there's one I don't trust. I bet I can really get nailed if I open that one. Click. We need to do something, because we're all sharing this risk. And it's shared in a very real sense. This country is being bled dry of intellectual property. And, you know, this is not a game. This is really our way of life that's being threatened. And we got to win this war. Okay? Thanks a lot. Lots of time for questions. Okay, well, thanks very much.
So, given the fact that we kind of need to live in the world, you know, I mean, there, and ideally, I mean, we know how to make our computers completely secure. I turn off my machine, pull out the batteries, and put a saw through the CPU. It isn't going to execute any.
I hope you don't do that too often, because it's expensive.
Yes, but we know at least one way to make them secure that doesn't seem practical. Given that we have to run our computers, I mean, you know, to live in the day-to-day world and all of the rest of this, and that we spend so much time, you know, at conferences like this trying to outdo ourselves and finding newer and better ways to demonstrate that we're crazy for using them, we've got this inherent conflict. In the end, we have to find ways that we can turn on our machine at night and check our email and check the bank balance and not feel like we're going to get raped, you know, and not know, in fact, to a certainty that we're going to, you know, that we're going to have bad things happen. So how do we get from here to there? How do we actually get assurance, especially given the fact that the commercial exigencies seem to dictate that people will not spend more money on the security of their products than they will on trying to make them functional enough to attract users?
Yeah, I think I told a story about when I was out at a big company on the West Coast, and the vice president of research said, you information assurance guys are a pain in the ass. The only good news is no matter what you do, my guys can get around it. And that's the real problem. People are involved at every step of this process. If people weren't involved, we'd all be okay.
So if we just replace the human race with a better design, it should all be straightforward?
That's not a bad idea. could you wait about 10 years? Yeah. People will make risk management decisions constantly. They'll avoid security. You have too many developers that don't understand security in the first place. We may have to fall back on crypto. I would love to find someone who can tell me. We used to design architectures back when I was in my previous job. where we had choke points, where we put got slices in that we had confidence in, so that no matter what happened bad in front of it or behind it, the got slice didn't let anything really bad happen. It's almost like a one-way diode, so stuff can come in, but nothing can get out. And now you can't have nothing get out, but something along those lines that the machine has got to be smart enough to compensate for the fact that the people using it are really going to try to do everything they can to make it susceptible. I don't know what the answer is. I just wish that we could work together to try to get someplace that where the good guys are safe. And when I talk good guys, for me, good guys are defenders and bad guys are attackers. So a whole lot of my very, very good friends are bad guys. And I enjoy telling them that. But that's the only way that it really works when you're talking to an international audience. That you've got to understand that good guy doesn't mean my country is good and your country is bad. Good guys means that the guys that are trying to defend the world are the good guys. And we have got to find a way that the defense changes the game. Hey, right now it's completely asymmetric, where offense is easy and cheap, and defense is extremely hard and extremely expensive, and we got to flip that. You just can't survive in that asymmetric world. It's also asymmetric in the sense that a lot of the adversaries don't have the same threat that we do, in the sense of they don't have the financial situation, they don't have the intellectual property, they don't have the things that we're trying to protect. So, short answer, I have no idea how you solve it. But I'm wishing you good luck, because you're still young enough to do it.
Hi, Lior from Intel. So you said that we need to do something about it, and you know, I've been in academia and now I'm in industry, and I served in the military as well. So I've been in several different organizations, and I'm trying to think, why do you think that we can do it, we as academia or we as industry? Because I'm thinking, if anyone has the money, that's the government.
Now, you haven't been reading the papers.
You have the defense budget, and you're the ones giving all the grants. And plus, you have time, you know? In industry, we need to deliver. There is time to market. You know, government people have time. Plus, you can deploy whatever you want. You have all the policy that you need. So I'm not, sorry, I shouldn't say you as an individual. I'm talking about the government. You know, so my question to you is, why do you think the government, with all the money and the time and what you've seen over the years, haven't come up with a better infrastructure for security for us?
Okay, well, I think that, If you go back to the early days of crypto, we did a pretty good job at that point in time, but the solutions were very simple. The government has gotten caught up with going from a GOTS world, where the government produced things and they'd come out with a product 20 years later, to a COTS world where they're using things every 18 months. I don't think that academia is going to solve it. I don't think that industry is going to solve it. I don't think the government's going to solve it, but together, I think we've got to work. Government does have some knowledge on security that industry doesn't have. Industry has more creativity than government. Government is lacking in creativity. The really good ideas are coming out of industry these days. Academia has the research brains, the foundational understanding. Together, we've got a shot at solving this problem. Individually, I don't think we can. None of those sectors can do it on their own. The country needs us all to work together to solve this. I don't think money is the answer. So it's going to cost money, but it's not. But money is not the answer. It's bright ideas, creativity, innovation, game-changing ideas. That's what we need. You're going to get that from. You're not getting that from my generation. Sorry. You're going to get that from the new kids that are coming up that have lived with this stuff from the early days of their lives. They know how to cheat in ways that I don't know how to cheat. They know this stuff inside out. They're the people that are going to fix it, I hope. That's where my hope is. I tell that to college kids all the time. I like speaking to students at college because I like to say, look, you guys are really smart, and you haven't used up your good ideas. Everybody has three or four good ideas in their life, and I've already used mine. But you guys have them still. Get them in this area because we need the help. But you're right. And by the way, when you say government has got the money, and if you've noticed, Congress isn't real good at figuring out how to make good use of that money that they dole out. So I wouldn't hold out a lot of hope for government coming up with a great solution on anything these days. And I'm retired, so I don't even get to vote anymore on how they spend that money. I didn't get to vote before either, by the way. Yeah.
Thank you.
Raj Rajagopalan from HP Labs. So I was actually going to ask a different question, but as I was standing in line, a comment you just made actually makes me ask this question. So I work in HP. It's an international organization, enterprise. We have, we work in all kinds of countries, including China. My boss is in Bristol, in England, and his boss is in Palo Alto. This causes for a really awkward conversation about security. Like, who are we defending against? Who are we defending? And what should be, what ought to be our values in this fight? It varies from, are we fighting for this country? Or are we fighting for our employer? If you're fighting for the employer, who exactly are we fighting for? The shareholder? We all struggle with this, and I sense some of that struggle even in your presentation today, that we simultaneously say, okay, we are, there are no boundaries here anymore. There are no national boundaries to say, okay, we are protecting this country from that, but we are in somehow this international space where it's becoming even harder to know who's fighting whom.
Yeah, I've been in that discussion so many times, which is why I've redefined good and bad to be defense and offense. If we can all agree that the defense is most important, and I'm okay in building defense that makes the Chinese government more secure, as long as it makes me more secure as well. If the good guys are all secure, then that's great. If the defense is good, you're right. Everything's international, and
right, but I think there's a further complication to this. It's not just international, but it's now we are in this nameless space where, so for example, if we want to draw the boundaries as good versus bad or defenders versus attackers, the problem is, say, industrial espionage. It's one company fighting another. It's not about, which country it's in, but, what they're competing for. And I think we really need to reboot this conversation about what security means in this new world.
Interesting thought. I still think that we can talk about defense, and whether it's company against company or country against country, there's an offense and a defense. And if we can make the defense good enough, and it's got to be a game changer, because you can't make it good enough under the model we have today. You can't patch all the holes. There's just no way you're ever going to get solutions that are as complicated as the solutions we have in place today to be secure. People aren't good enough to do that things that well. If we can figure out how to protect ourselves, and maybe it comes back to crypto, because that seems to be the primitive that does provide security, but I don't know how you're going to reboot it.
Okay, thank you.
I wish I did.
Hi, Rick Farrow. Well, you partly answered, or you gave a partial answer to the question I was going to pose, but I want to back up a little bit. Yesterday, there was a nice paper about something called Quark, which is a way to do secure web browsing. And in their solution, they would put the most dangerous part of the code into a sandbox and then have a small section of code they call the shim that they could prove would have, supposedly would be secure. And it's 750 lines, there's a likelihood you can make something fairly secure that's only 750 lines long. But the weakness to their design is a sandbox. Now, this is not something you can solve with crypto. And you know, crypto is not a magic bullet because, as Dr. Blaze has... That's not fair. Yeah, okay. Thanks, Dr. Blaze. He's found, I remember the work he did on the Leaf and the Clipper chip, finding that people had used triple DES with a key of all zeros and various different mistakes you could make of crypto. So what I'd like to imagine, say for that design yesterday, is that there was actually hardware support where you ran the dangerous stuff inside of a hardware sandbox. And this becomes a programming model. So most all code runs in a hardware sandbox, and it has a very narrowly defined interface to the rest of the world, which is then managed by something like the shim that the Quark people are talking about. Now, I envision there's really two big problems with this, and one is the inertia. You know, as you mentioned, or somebody, I think it was Cynthia mentioned, you give somebody a three-week course in Java, now they're supposed to be a secure programmer. The other is that, and this is the one that you alluded to in your previous answer, suppose we created a system that took security up in an order of magnitude improvement, because when you did something out of the box, it'd be more secure. We had this hardware support for security, which we don't have because we're running designs out of the 60s still. Are we willing to share that with the Chinese? I have a feeling right now that even if the Chinese steal our intellectual property, we're also into their government networks, and this is just as easy for us to get in as it is for them to get into our networks because they're using the same stuff. And I've heard stories where certain, say, internet protocols haven't been improved because it makes it much easier for us to control the routing on the internet. So there's actually been a reason, you know. So are we going to create that magical technology that's really going to improve things? Because it's so basic that even a duller Java programmer can't do it wrong, because then we're giving it to our enemies as well.
Okay. I'll give you a few answers to that. First of all, when you're coming up with patchwork solutions, I'm not trying to say it's not good. I'm saying that you're finding workarounds in some sense. What you do is you always drive the adversary, you always drive the attacker to a new place. Whenever the defender sets up new rules of the game, the adversary tries to figure out where he can go. So in that case, if you've got a hardware sandbox, he's going to try to get into the hardware. Mm-hmm. And it could be a life cycle, it could be supply chain. There are various ways, but you will always drive him to some place, to the easiest place to get in. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as would we be willing to share it, absolutely. One of the tests that I always have, and I really like this test, whenever I'm talking to somebody who plays offense, I always say, let's ask the general. And you go to a general and you say, are you more concerned with knowing what your adversary is thinking or protecting your own troops? There's no hesitation. It's always, you protect my troops. Don't worry about the other guy. As long as my troops are safe, I'll win. So defense always wins in those situations. And the general does get to make that decision. So there's no problem with sharing if we get security out of it. I still always worry that we keep chasing the adversary from this easy place to get into this easy place to get into this easy place, and maybe every one of them is harder, but none of them are hard enough that we're keeping them out.
Right. Okay.
Did I miss anything?
No. You really answered my basic question.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you.
Bill Cheswick, insert your institution name here. There's been a model that I think could be used a bit more. I know you folks vet software for high-level networks. You want to run something on JWix, and you're going to check libc and OpenSSL if you run that, and that sort of stuff. And I know you spend a lot of money checking the software that goes on there. It seems to me it would be a useful practice to supply that software, if you're willing, and I want your comment on this, to us. I would like to have OpenSSL with your stamp of approval, something you've spent six figures on. It's a chance to justify some of the black budget. It's a Linux SE model a little bit. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, I think that's perfectly reasonable. There's no reason I wouldn't want to share that. I think that you'll hear people say things like, well, you know, then you're just making it easier for the adversary. I don't think that's really true. I think the benefits far outweigh any adversarial problem. Of course, I don't, you know, I'm retired.
Yeah.
But I would be happy to support that. I don't see any problem with doing that at all.
Steve Belevin, Columbia University. What should be the rules of the road internationally, say, for a treaty or understanding on things happening in cyberspace? I've seen comments from very high officials, might even have been General Alexander himself, saying, well, we don't like cyber attacks, we'd like to outlaw them, but cyber exploitation is good. And by the way, as everyone knows, and as you pointed out, we don't really know where any of this is coming from when it shows up. How do you enforce something like this? So what do the rules be and how do we enforce it?
I think that, first of all, he's right that no one's going to pay attention to the rules if they are set up. That's that line in the sand. And as Victor was saying, he knows that he would abide by those rules, but he knew that none of his allies were paying attention to those rules, and that bothered him. If he's saying that, I got to believe him. So I think that the chances of us getting an international agreement are pretty slim. I love the idea of, so what he's saying is, look, espionage is espionage. We've been doing it for as long as we've been people. And that's going to continue, but war is bad. And so he's saying, you can go after information, go ahead, do the CNE stuff, don't do the CNA stuff. I got to tell you, what's going to happen is that everybody's going to develop the CNA tools, and I think it's been, I certainly have heard it said that the human race has never developed a weapon that they haven't used. And I think that the question is not going to be what will people not use that. It's when will the people use it, and who's going to be the first one to use it, and how will it escalate after that? I don't have as much faith in people as General Alexander does.
I've seen speculation that one of the things that kept the peace during the Cold War was not just deterrence, but the success of Soviet espionage and American espionage. We each knew the other wasn't launching an attack.
That is, in fact, true. And in some sense, I was very happy that they knew as much about us as they did, because that gave them the confidence that they didn't have to launch an attack. I think that's absolutely right.
Hi, Matt Plays from UPenn. You mentioned in your talk yesterday, early on in the talk, about what I think you were giving as a positive example of something that was secure, the Vinson-based two-way radio, and you mentioned that it was, you know, because it was a simple device that had basically this one function, you could have some confidence that it worked as it is. So I went to the NSA Museum website and I found the picture of the thing and I figured out the model number, and I found the current version of that radio, which is still backwards compatible with Vinson, the PRC-152 radio, and I went down the list of features, and here it has things like this list of waveforms, including P25, which we found some vulnerabilities in last year. It has AES encryption among the type 1 things listed. It has the ability to go into unencrypted FM mode. And it has a nice feature called wireless radio to radio cloning, which I imagine is quite an interesting vector. So somehow this simple device has been replaced with a device that has essentially the same function, but you can't have any confidence that you can't have the same kind of confidence that you had in the thing that it's replaced, because it's just too complex to reason about.
So welcome to my life.
Yeah. So it seems like the defenders, the conservative designers, lost, even for this critical classified application, in allowing this these things to become so complex. And this is a pretty simple example.
You're right on all counts. It is simple, and yet it's more complex. And every time we make something more complex, we open up problems.
Right. So you know, I mean, it sounds like if the NSA can't even push back against that trend, how do the rest of us have any chance?
Yeah. Well, we're all in this together, you know. But you're absolutely right.
Well,
this functionality is a killer. The complexity is a killer. You know, when you're getting a 50 million line operating system, you know, we had little examples where you put mistakes, intentionally put mistakes in small bits of code, 700 lines, and it asks people to find it. I was talking to Tony Hoare one time, and his goal was to come up with a perfect system so that your code would always compile to be exactly as it was intended to be. And I'm not sure how you ever achieve that. You know, just a perfect compiler doesn't do it, because it's supposed to just fix all the problems in some sense. But that still doesn't save you if somebody has put a back door in it. It just means you get a perfectly well-written back door. And you're always going to have those problems, that complexity. And we know there are backdoors and things. I've found them. It's not easy, but you do find them.
So I'm worried that there's no one behind me, and I'm hoping someone can ask a question that will end on an optimistic note.
There might be cookies at the break. Thanks a lot, all.